Good evening, James McCanna here with my Science Hour for March 18th, 2021. A lot of topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about dust devils. What the heck are dust devils? They're little whirlwinds that come across the southwestern plain of the United States and seen around the world in dusty areas, flat areas especially, and also on Mars. The Perseverance lander rover on Mars has seen its first one. So how come Mars, with its very thin atmosphere, has dust devils? What's going on? What causes them? I'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about another topic, lunar lightning. What is the cause of lightning that's seen on the moon? Then a little bit about St. Patrick's Days, carrying over the topic of Israelites becoming Christians. That's a topic that did not come out in my talks of the past 2 weeks. And then here's an article about a listener had sent in about a alleged Middle Eastern group of people who moved through Central Europe in the what they say is a range about 5500 BC, and their claim to fame was that they drank milk. They had lactose tolerance, and this is something, as a person growing up in dairy country, I would drink a half a gallon of milk at supper myself. And so I don't know how my parents handled it, but milk was readily available. And a lot of my friends could not drink milk. And I'd get done with football practice or baseball practice or something like that, or a hot summer day, and I'd come in and take a half a gallon of milk and just hold it up and drink it, and people would look at me like I was insane. But one thing that did was it gave me very strong bones, a lot of calcium. And it turns out, just a little fun fact, I just am throwing this in, to use calcium, your body needs to extract it from animal fat. And the best source of that is milk. Whole milk, that is. And also giving kids skim milk or low-fat milk is really bad because they need it for their bone construction and they need it for their nervous system construction. So whoever telling you to give your kids skim or low-fat milk is really steering you in the wrong direction. Those kids need that fat. They need the calcium, and very important. But anyway, this group of people allegedly had the ability to make cheese and other milk byproducts. And that was the reason for their success. And this is very interesting. But the reason I want to talk about these people is because they're posted at around 5500 BC. And it just drives me crazy when archaeologists put a date on things. Dating something is a very difficult thing to do. And the carbon dating techniques for very recent things maybe work okay, a couple hundred years, but you start getting back into the thousands of years, there are other factors that come into play. Okay, so anyway, I'll be talking about students, college students living in Mars environments. Pretend, let's go to Mars, let's all play in a sandbox, pretend we're going to Mars. And then this leads into the top 10 reasons why nobody is going to Mars. I don't know if I have 10 reasons, but I have close to 10. And then I'll be also talking about the lawsuits that are going. They just have been registered in the Hague court, regarding the Nuremberg, the results of the World War II Nuremberg trial, that you cannot do experimentation on individuals without their consent. And right now they're taking Israel to court and Germany to court for heavy-handedness and also that the leaders of Israel signed an accord with Pfizer to essentially experiment on the human population of Israel with the vaccine. And so then they pushed this on the people required. Israel has one of the highest vaccination rates, but it was done in a very heavy-handed way and without the consent of the people of understanding what this was, an experimental program. Okay, so I'll be talking about that. and then a little bit of review on my products, something that throw in every week. This is a commercial-free show, but I do make the money that supports my work and everything off of selling products. I pay for my own airtime, and if you don't buy anything, if you don't support me in any way, you still get to listen to this for free. Okay, so back to the original topic, dust devils on Earth. Now, what is a dust devil? Essentially, it's a tornado. It's a little whirlwind, and if you've ever been out to the Southwest Desert, anywhere out there, on a nice, hot, sunny day, all of a sudden you see these little whirlwind things coming across, and a lot of times they'll have sagebrush, the tumbleweed, and the tumbleweed is rolling around. That's a very interesting plant. I'm not going to talk about that. But these tumbleweeds roll around, and then they re-root in different places, and that's the way they carry their seeds, etc. But anyway, they're a lot of times associated with the little whirlwind called dust devils. And so I'll also talk about something I've seen on lakes, very interesting phenomenon. As the water is warming up early in the morning up in the Canadian wilderness. But anyway, a dust devil, what causes it? Well, it turns out that it is an electric current. And the spinning is caused by the electrical current being pulled up. It's the same thing that causes hurricanes, tornadoes, cyclonic storms, waterspouts. And, of course, standard meteorology has no explanation for these. Their explanation for a tornado is that two cloud systems or two weather systems rub together, whatever that is. How do they rub together and forms a whirlwind, and that's what the tornado is. Well, it's ludicrous because you can find tornadoes coming out. I've got a great picture of one. I think it's in my Atlantis to Tesla book, but it's a whirlwind tornado coming out of the top of Mount Vesuvius. And so clearly there's no weather systems there that are rubbing together. The picture was taken on a clear, bright, blue, sunny day, no clouds, no weather. And so anyway, what's causing this? Well, these are electrical currents. The Earth atmosphere has probably about 300 volts per meter electric field. And you'd think, well, gee, why can't we tap into that and run our businesses and get our electrical needs? And the reason you cannot is because of the dielectric of the air. The air itself is an insulator, so it's not going to allow current to pass. So you can have a high voltage in a capacitor, but no current is going to pass, so you cannot draw any power out of that. But there's a solution to that, from which Tesla was the first one to actually activate that solution. And I was the first one to understand what he was doing. He was tapping into the vertical electric field, but he understood that you couldn't just get it from the immediate air around your location. You had to get up to the other side of that capacitor, which is up in the ionosphere. Okay, so anyway, he built the Wardenclyffe Tower. He was doing his experiments in Colorado Springs, where you get the electricity from the air. And of course, Colorado Springs is on the Colorado Plateau, so you're already at about a 5,000 foot elevation. And Tesla, in his very well engineered programs, probably understood that. And he was it's like, say, launching a spacecraft. You're better off if you're at a high altitude, like, say, launching from Denver would have been a much better pick than launching from Florida, because at Florida you're at sea level. At Denver, you're already at 5,000 feet, or you could NASA could have constructed a railroad train to go up to the top of a tall mountain, say 10,000 or 12,000 feet, and launch from there. And that's already, that first few miles, you're burning a lot of fuel to get out of the Earth's atmosphere, and then you're that much closer to outer space. But anyway, the Earth has an electric field, and it's in a capacitor. And so what happens on a very local level, There is a local electrical discharge, and what happens is that on a hot, nice hot day in the sun, you don't see dust devils at night, but in the daytime you find that the sun will do a little bit of ionization of air, and that air starts moving up the column, and it finds, like any short circuit, it'll find the path of least resistance, and when it does, it starts discharging, and that upward moving current, it's just like when you take water and pour it down a drain, it starts to swirl. And in the northern hemisphere, it turns in one direction, and the southern hemisphere turns in the opposite direction. So if you found dust devils in the southern hemisphere, around the desert areas of South America, they would spin in a different direction. And that's because of the electrical currents moving upwards. The rotation of the Earth is what causes the spin. Okay, so at any rate, it's the electrical currents forming in the Earth's atmosphere that cause the dust devils, and the dust is just dust from the surface of the desert floor being spun up. And one time I saw a water spout. I was down in the Caribbean, where I've spent a lot of time, and I looked out over the ocean, and there's a water spout. Kind of like they're very beautiful to watch, but very dangerous. You don't want to, if you're in a relatively small boat, you do not want to tangle with a water spout. So anyway, that's basically a tornado over water, but how does it form? It's the same process. And of course, meteorology has no explanation for water spouts. They try and tell you that a hurricane is caused by warm water. That's just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, it couldn't be. I mean, in no way, shape, or form does it have all of does warm water cause all the properties of a hurricane? It's once again the electrical discharge up to the ionosphere. And you can see the clouds forming as they come out off of Africa in the Atlantic, for example. And those cloud systems are forming and billowing up. And all of a sudden, one of the very highest cumulonimbus clouds starts to arc to the up to the ionosphere. And then that current sheet starts. And because it's over water, over land, you have a short circuit to land. But over the water, you do not. So what you end up with is ionization along the surface layer of the water. That ionization it's ionized, and therefore it starts to move with the vertical electric field, and it'll find a column, and it typically finds a column upwards at the base of that tallest cumulonimbus cloud. And you can see this when you're looking from the top side, from satellites looking down, you can see those tall, billowing cumulonimbus clouds. That's where the hurricane eye starts, and then the eye starts to form, and then if it keeps developing, then the eye gets bigger and more well-formed. And the rotation is the same situation as rotation with the dust devils, with the water spouts, with the tornadoes, with the cyclonic storms in general. Okay, so anyway, Perseverance, the little rover that just landed on Mars, observed its first dust devil on Mars. And so what's causing dust devils on Mars? Well, it's the very same process. Mars has an ionosphere. It has a vertical electric field in its atmosphere. And so the dust devils are common. But the dust devils on Mars can be big. They can be big and ferocious. And that's one of the issues that people are going to have to deal with when they're on Mars, is that during a certain season of the year, Mars develops basically a planet-wide dust storm. And the wind's going to get up to hundreds of miles per hour. So it's basically sand blasting. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that you would understand that Mars could not possibly that the oceans on Mars could not be billions of years old, like NASA's trying to tell you. Every time I turn around, they just came out with a video this last week talking about the ancient oceans on Mars. Well, they ain't ancient. That's hard to say. They ain't ancient, NASA. They're very recent. And the reason for understanding they're recent is because you see all of these water geological features all over Mars, very pristine riverbeds, etc. And if the water had been there billions of years ago, all of those surface features would be gone, gone, gone. And so the fact that they are there very prominent and in very pristine condition tells you that Mars had oceans and waters recently, like in the last few thousand years. And that corresponds with the fact that Venus came by and took all of its oceans and atmosphere away. And that's what the ancients tell us. Okay, so at any rate, a little bit on atmospheric electricity there. Just a comment, yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, the patron saint of Ireland. And of course, you might have guessed I might be Irish and my descendants, etc. So the St. Patrick's Day celebrates the, I believe, the death of St. Patrick, March 17th, where all of the world gets to be Irish. And so the Irish typically make fun of themselves, too. There's a lot of jokes told by Irish about the Irish and good humor. We're not the kind of people there. The Irish are very fun-loving people. They're very music-oriented. They're very family-oriented. And by the way, they happen to be Israelites. Israelites. And so the point of my talk this week is that the Israelites were from the Old Testament. They were the houses of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, or that were descendants of Abraham, of the children of Abraham. So anyway, but as Christendom came into being around the year zero, what we talk now in terms of the calendar years, the years with the reckoning that we use today is based on after AD, after the death of Christ. So our entire calendar, there's people walking around going, gee, I wonder if Christ was real. Well, yeah, he was real. He was a historical character, and Joseph of Arimathea was his great uncle, the uncle of Mary. I talked about that a couple of weeks ago, spent a lot of time talking about that. But the interesting thing is when Christendom hit, it then moved amongst the Israelites. The Israelites were promised a savior. Christ was the savior. And the Israelites then became Christian. Okay, so this is very interesting. So there again, you have Ireland, Scotland, most of England that wasn't invaded by the Zionist Jesuit banker world community, who set up the queens and kings of most of the European empires. Israelites in Scandinavia and Northern Germany became Christian. And so that's a very interesting piece of history, that Christianity followed the Israelites. And when all these people finally moved to the United States, remember that the original settlers were pilgrims looking for religious freedom, and then came waves and waves, but the waves and waves of people came from Ireland, Scotland, England, and remember the French were vying for the United States, other countries were vying for the United States, but the Israelites were the ones that weathered it out and became the founders of the United States. So the United States was founded on Israelite Christian principles. That's the point. And today the Israelites have forgotten who they are. The Christians have forgotten who they are. It really upsets me when I see churches and Christian churches, and they go in there and they're all humble pie and let's do this. They're encouraging people to get their COVID shot, which is, a church should not be doing that. They should be the biggest mouthpiece against it or against voter tyranny or whatever else is going on in this country, but they're not. They're lackadaisical. They preach, you know, I call them prayer repeaters. And it's unfortunate, but Christians have always been fighters, people who stood up for their rights. And now your family rights, your Christian values are being trampled on and nobody's saying anything. At the local level, you should be out there demanding politicians keep the Christian values. That's what this country was founded on. Anybody that doesn't like it, go camp somewhere else. But at any rate, I just wanted to make that point that the Israelites, who I talked about a few weeks ago, I'm not going to repeat all of that, when Christianity came around, they became the ardent Christians. And it's because they were expecting a Savior, and that Savior came in the name of Christ, and they, the Israelites adopted it immediately. But St. Patrick, historically, St. Patrick was not an Irishman. He was from England, and it was probably safe to say that he was a Celt, a descendant of that's a term given to the Israelites. But it's safe to say he was probably an Israelite also. But anyway, he was taken as a young boy from his parents' farm in England, in coastal England, taken over to Ireland, where he was basically in captivity until he grew up, and then he went off and he just lived by himself, basically. I think he worked on farms and things like that, and then he picked up his ministry and became basically a priest. Probably not as quite a rigid a process as there is today. But then he went out and he taught the people of Ireland, and he's the one that brought Christianity to the Israelites, who were living, you know, they had their earth gods and their deities, and centralized and crystallized the idea of Christianity, and all of Ireland and all of Scotland became Christian. And so anyway, St. Patrick was the person credited for doing that. And there's all kinds of myths and fables around St. Patrick's. But yesterday, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, everybody gets to be Irish. And so it's one of those things. There's really no other nationality that does this. The Arabs or the Jews of Israel don't go out and say, hey, everybody today can be a Jew. They don't do that. You know, the Arabs don't say, hey, everybody today can be an Arab. But make no mistake about it. The Irish is part of the Israelite race. It's a race of people. And so you have to know your heritage. But the Irish, very fun-loving, music-oriented people, love dance, very hardworking, shipbuilders, farmers, etc. And on St. Patrick's Day, they say, hey, everybody, you can be like us today. Go out and have a beer, drink, you know, whatever. Don't get drunk. But the Irish are somewhat famous, and they're famous for being fighters. They became the police force in a lot of places. And by the way, it's very interesting that when they defund the police force in a lot of places, they're defunding the Israelites who make up those police forces. And of course, now it's mixed. You have a lot of blacks. You have a lot of, in the southern states, you have a lot of Latin people on the police forces, etc. But the United States started out, the Irish became the policemen, the firemen, the civil servants, so to speak, in a lot of communities. And very famously in, say, Chicago or New York and other places, the Irish were very, very much involved in those public services. Okay, just quickly here, there's an article sent in by a listener that was published in Der Spiegel. This is about a migration of Middle Eastern people who were milk drinkers, and they say around 5500 BC conquered Europe. And I really think that it's that dating, this is the point in bringing this up. Now, I started out talking in the show about when I was a little kid drinking milk. And so I did not have a problem with lactose. And I think a lot of people today have that problem. That's why there's milk that's that has it removed. And so anyway, the point is that these people when they dug up their settlements and the archaeology that went along with it, they had the very clearly cows and animals and milk. And so the lactose tolerance was something that gave these people an edge up on other people who depended on the earth for all of their food, etc. Because milk, if you can have milk, it has protein, it has a lot of the enzymes that you need. There are people that could live just off of milk. I think I did as a kid. I drank a lot of milk. So anyway, that's not usual. There's a lot of cultures, civilizations, races around the world who do not have lactose tolerance. And so they, but this group allegedly had advantage because of the ability to drink and digest milk. And it's actually genetic. There's actually a gene that allows you to, you know, your body to have the ability to digest milk. So at any rate, my point here is that on the dating, when they put a 5,500 BC date on these people, where do they come up with this date? And the problem with archaeology is once you put a date on something, on a civilization or a discovery, that date tends to stick, and it's very hard to get rid of. And too many times you got some guy who's an archaeologist who goes out to the site, and I saw this for myself. When I lived in Mexico, I went out to digs, and some of them were being dug up for the very first time. Now they're major tourist areas. And I'd watch the main archaeologist on the site as they were bringing up masks and artifacts. And the archaeologist would go, "Oh, well, that's from the classic period, da-da-da," and put a date and stamp it and send it off to the museum in Mexico City. But the point is, a couple things, they didn't do anything with the dirt that was on top of the pyramids. That should have been as much of an analysis point of discovering and classifying the dirt, because that tells you all of the history of what happened to that location after these places were abandoned. And they don't do that. They just take the dirt away and haul it away and dump it someplace. It's criminal. So the whole point is that I don't trust dates. And people all the time want to pin me down and say, "What do you think about dates? When was the Moses event, or when was the Venus event, or when is Planet X going to come?" And people want to, you know, pin me down on dates. And it's like, no, I don't do that. I don't play that game. I look at things, and I look at, for example, the Venus event. What I say about that is that Velikovsky was the master of that, and he put a 1500 BC date on that, and that looks pretty good. But there again, there's, you know, putting a date on something is very tricky. And too many people in academia and other places put a date on something and really don't have good justification for putting that date. And I believe that this is one of those cases where that this could have been 1500 BC, not 5500 BC, when the lactose tolerance people, which would have been Israelites, came through Europe after the Moses event. This would have been another 400 or 500 years afterwards, after the Moses event, which, if you put it at 1500 BC, which is the Velikovsky dating, then that would put that migration at somewhere around 1000 BC or 800 BC. And so, and not 5500 BC. Or were there two groups of people? Were there two groups of people that moved through this region at different times that both that had lactose tolerance? Anyway, so there's not, I don't have an answer to the question. It's just that somebody wrote that in, and to take a look at that article, and I thought it was very interesting, because in the last few weeks I've been talking about major migrations that go through Central Europe in historically, like I say 1000 BC or earlier. Okay, this is something I find comical. There are students at universities and colleges who are like pretend living in a Mars environment. Let me tell you, boys and girls, grandpas and grandmas, and everybody in between, you have no concept, And I find this too, where I've seen more and more, like, oh, we're going to go to Mars, and it's just like I saw one guy writing, just describing what he thought a nice spring day on Mars would be like, with a gentle breeze blowing and the smell of flowers. And I thought, you know, what are these people smoking? I'm serious. What on earth are these people smoking? Mars is a harsh environment. It's even worse than the moon, because on the moon you don't have an atmosphere, so you don't have the dust storms, 300-mile-an-hour winds that are going to sandblast. Do you know what sand does at 300 miles an hour? It destroys everything. It takes the paint off, takes the finish off. Anything that, you know, most materials cannot withstand that. It destroys. And so how do you get out of, you know, on Mars, you would have to dig down, make, caves. And so for that period of the year, the Martian year, when you have these tremendous dust storms, what are you going to do? Spend months and months underground in your cave, in your Mars cave? And these students, you know, it drives me crazy, because somebody's putting these kids up to this. Thinking, oh, you're going to go to Mars, just like a shopping trip to the mall. You know, you got your credit card, you buy something, hey, a couple McDonald's hamburgers, and you're good to go on Mars. No, Mars is a horrifically vile environment, and you're not going to go there and just kind of hang out with the kids. So anyway, I wrote down the top, and I've talked about this before, but I'm a little more organized tonight. The top reason why nobody is going to Mars. First of all, the radiation is not understood. And the reason there's radiation, and I learned this from my work with the Russian scientists in the 1990s, who said they sent astronauts, cosmonauts, up through the Van Allen belts, and they were very much dead. They were French fried. And here's what happens. Here's the physical process of which NASA knows nothing about. You have basically a positive and a negative sphere in the Van Allen belts. You have the proton belt, and then you have the electron belt, and they can split and they can come close together. They can drop down. They're constantly moving. They're constantly being fed with more protons and more electrons from the solar wind that tunnel through and merge into the Van Allen belt. So they're co-rotating magnetic fields that are coupled to Earth's magnetic fields. That's what they are. They are orbiting high-energy particles, and these can be relativistic. So they're really whipping around in Earth's magnetic environment. And so what happens when those particles hit something, they create X-rays. When you go to the dentist and he puts that thing up by the side of your mouth and goes, "Eat," like that, creates X-rays. That's how those X-rays are created, in that X-ray machine. Or if you go to the doctor and you get a plate put behind you and they take an X-ray and you go, "Zzz," you know, and the technician walks behind a iron, you know, a lead shield, so they're not irradiated all the time from the extraneous radiation coming off this head, this X-ray head. That's how they create the X-rays. They take high-energy particles, slam them into a plate. It creates X-rays, and on a low level, it's not enough to kill you. So there's a certain safe level. They call it safe. I don't think it's safe. But at any rate, the idea is that X-rays are the things that are dangerous. Now, if you look back at the NASA Apollo program, the astronauts there had alpha-beta detectors. They did not have X-ray detectors because they didn't know about them. So alpha and beta particles are low-energy particles. That's all they were looking for. They didn't know about the high probability of having X-ray problems when you go through the Van Allen belts. How come NASA's never gone back to above low Earth orbit? They actually have, by mistake, a couple times, and the eyebrows of the astronauts would start to glow and have electrical discharges, like they were touching a Van Allen Van de Graaff generator or something. And so anyway, radiation is, and they're going to be gone for a couple years. This is about a 7-year trip in outer space. So you have weightlessness, extended periods of weightlessness. This is number two reason. Radiation is number one. Weightlessness for that long a period. Nobody in history in the space program, Russian, U.S., Chinese, or anybody else, has ever been in space for up to 7 years with low gravity, little or no gravity. So, I mean, how are you going to go to a place and the people that go up into space for extended periods of time have problems? And so now the trip to Mars is probably about 6 to 9 months. That's pure weightlessness. And so now you get to Mars, and here's you got a problem because you have to come back into the atmosphere and have that impact of slowing down. It's not like going to the moon. You're going much faster. So the impact coming into the Martian atmosphere is going to be much greater. And here you're bringing people off complete weightlessness into a high-G environment. Boom. And they're not going to be able to handle it. Their bodies are not going to be able to handle it because they're used to weightlessness. So, and just even if it were not for that, the whole period of time that these people would be gone from the time they leave the Earth's surface to the time they get to Mars, spend some time on Mars and come back, is going to be about 6 to 7 years. And so everything they need, the water, the food, the conversion equipment to convert CO2 to oxygen, the equipment to convert urine and human waste back into usable products. I mean, and this stuff can't break. You ever been on a weekend where your water system broke at home and your toilet didn't work? It's not fun. Try doing that on a 7-year trip to Mars, baby. Yeah, that'll ruin your weekend. People have no clue. These students, like, oh, we got a Mars environment. Let me tell you something. You do not. You do not have a Mars environment. Believe me, you simply don't. Okay, so weightlessness for extended periods of time. Untested equipment. Oh, my goodness. Let me explain something from an engineering point of view. Here is what is known as mean time between failure. Say you have, let's take a two-component system. Let's take a very simple system that has two components. And so you say, this is something that has to go on a shelf and work and do some kind of task. And so how do you calculate the mean time between failure of this working machine? Well, you take the average, you test it, first of all. You have to test it for the length of time, the length of time of whatever it's going to be. So like going to Mars, if it's 7 years, you better test your equipment for a period of 14 to maybe 21 years to see that it's going to work, because you can't have this stuff failing on the way to Mars or coming back. You cannot have it failing. So you need every component in this system tested for a minimum of, say, 20 to possibly 30 years. And you can test things by, say, moving them back and forth many times. That's a way of accelerating the testing process. But you don't have cumulative radiation. You don't have a way of testing that. You don't have a accumulation of, say, solar radiation. You don't have accumulation of other electrical issues. Let me tell you a story. When the first navigators came across the ocean to the New World, they had ships that were built of hardwoods from Europe, oak, different types of very dense fir or pine, etc. That's what the boats were built out of. They didn't have a problem in Europe, but they came across the ocean, and in the tropics, the worms got into the wood. There's a worm that lives in the water that just loves to eat wood. And by the time they got back, Columbus, remember, came in three ships, the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, came to the New World. Only one of those boats made it back to Spain. Only one of those boats. Can you imagine if Columbus went on this trip and did not get back at all? So he had one ship that actually made it back. The other ones were eaten apart by the worms in the water. And so in the tropics, you have to put a copper-based paint or some kind of paint on your hull to kill off the organisms that are trying to eat you, the boat right out from under you. Let me take another example. In ships, big ships made out of steel or other types of metal, there's a thing called electrolysis. In the seawater, you have it's a conductor. That's what basically the Edison battery was modeled after, was the seawater conducting electrolyte. And so anyway, what happens is that different types of metals have different surface potentials, which means that the electrons will leave them at a different rate based on their surface potential that typically would hold those electrons in, because the seawater is a conductor. So if you have stainless steel and bronze on the same boat, the bronze will eat the stainless steel. It'll eat it alive. And I saw a boat one time, a sailboat, big one, ocean-going sailboat, and the keel bolts going down into the iron keel were stainless steel. And you think, oh, stainless steel, it'll last forever. No, they were all gone. They were gone. The electrolysis had completely eaten them up. And this guy's keel was hanging on by a thread. Okay, so anyway, to counter this, you put a zinc block on the outside of your hull. You just attach it there. And what happens is, because it has the lowest surface potential of all the other metals, that gets eaten away before the other metals do. That's where the electrical currents go to. And so that zinc plate, you have to renew that. You have to have these on your hull. On the underwater side of your hull, so that they get eaten up, not the other metal in your boat. Okay, so there's going to be things like this that they discover once they start going out to Mars. Untested equipment. And so let me get back to this concept of mean time between failure. Columbus didn't know that when he got to the tropics, he was going to have a problem with worms. That was the last thing he had no concept of this. Okay. So anyway, if you have a device with, say, two components, and the mean time between failure for one component is 1 year, and the mean time between failure of the other component is 1 year, then the combined mean time between failure for the two parts working together is a half of a year. That gives you an idea of how to calculate mean time between failure. Now let's take something as complicated as a Mars mission. And this is something, too, I get people, oh, you know, Elon Musk is going to send a lot of spacecraft to Mars and with equipment and food and all of this stuff. Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, a big part of this time is going to be these people in a little spacecraft going between Earth and Mars. And okay, so let me get back to mean time between failure. Take something that is as complicated as a rocket engine or other complicated physical systems. The mean time between failure is the combination of failure rates of all those components combined. And so anyway, if you have something with 100 components, then and their mean time between failure individually is 1 year, then the 100 components, the combined mean time between failure is about 3 days. Something in that system is going to fail once every 3 days. That's the mean time between failure of the system. Okay, so now if you have a system with thousands of parts, you see where this is going. I'm just giving you some examples, and nobody's doing this mean time between failure analysis. Okay, and even if it's really well built, you're going to have some part in there that's going to have a problem. And there might be reasons for that part to have a problem that you don't even foresee. So you can't send a material stresses, all the other things that go with it. All of your equipment is with you. You know, it's like the covered wagons when they went across the open plains. And I always make a joke about this, that if NASA had the contract to settle the Great West, they would have prevented anybody from going there, first of all. They would have sent one covered wagon with all of the gadgets and widgets that you could imagine, you know, with everything that these three people, they would send three people in the covered wagon to explore the great American West. And when they got to the West Coast, they would have proclaimed it a top secret. And nobody would ever been able to go there. That's what would happen if NASA had the contract or the edict to explore the great American West. And instead, what they did, they just opened it up to the public and they said, go for it. You know, people walking across the plains and you know, everything that went with it. And they learned as they went and all of the hardships that they went through, etc. But that's what NASA would do if it had the edict to explore the great American West. Okay, so the taking replacement parts. Now, whenever you go on a trip like this to Mars, you're going to need replacement parts. That takes weight. So like say you're driving your car down the road and you got your muffler goes out, your brakes go out, or your shock absorbers go out, or they, you know, the horn doesn't work anymore, or something. Something breaks, you know, the electronic ignition thing breaks or something, or your fuel injectors get clogged. Okay, you drive into the garage and they have spare parts there. They take out the old ones, put in the new ones, and then you drive away and you're good to go again. Ain't nothing like this on Mars. There ain't no parts stores for your Tesla rocket. Okay, and so you got to take all this stuff with you. All that stuff has weight to it. So you have to take the equivalent of your critical systems, two or three replacement parts for each one of these. That takes weight. Okay, so there again, you know, this is, that by itself is not a showstopper. This is physical equipment. But the biggest showstopper is that you're sending people. Sending equipment to Mars, that's one thing. Sending people to Mars and getting them all back in one piece and through the Van Allen belts, which is a problem. And now I just saw a thing of Elon Musk, and he was touting how that there, you know, the Apollo space program, there was no issue of, you know, how great the Apollo space program was. Why doesn't one of these groups send a living entity, a mouse, you know, an experimental lab mouse or rat or a dog or a monkey or something, through the Van Allen belts? Prove that you can do it. And I think they're going to find out that, no, it's not as easy as you can think, as you think. It's a big issue. And the X-ray, what happens, there's two things. You can have electrical discharges between the Van Allen belts themselves, the plus and the minus belts. You can discharge because that spacecraft is going through them, and that's where the discharges are going to occur. And then the other issue is the fact that you're going through these belts of relativistic particles, high-energy particles. When those hit metal, they're going to create X-rays, and that X-ray is going to be burning the people alive in that, basically, an X-ray chamber. That's the problem. Nobody seems to understand or care about this. NASA had a program for a while. It's called Living with a Star. That still is in existence. They don't talk about it much. I was involved in and around that program. I was watching the scientists try and solve this. They had physicists, chemists, they had astrophysicists, they had everybody working on this. The question is, how do you deal with radiation when you're in outer space? And nobody has ever come up with a solution. And there's a reason for that. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that tonight, but conditions on Mars, the environmental conditions on Mars are just horrendous. And the one last thing I want to mention is NASA is going Hollywood. There's another movie coming out, The Right Stuff, another movie. But basically, a long time ago, NASA went Hollywood. So they're selling their programs basically through Hollywood. Okay, a few minutes left. I got 10 minutes left. I want to turn to something very, very important. The COVID shots have been just kind of ramrodded down everybody's throat. And it's like, oh, look at how fast they got these together. Well, that's not the way you do experimental. And this is not a vaccine. Don't call it a vaccine. It's not. It is a DNA-altering process. And if you listen to Dr. Tenpenny, she describes that they have tried this for decades and decades on animals in the laboratory, and it has not worked. This has not worked. The animals die. They have all kinds of side effects. And so basically they're using the human population as guinea pigs. And I predict that in, well, basically in 9 months, you're going to start to see the birth defects come out. You're going to start to see the babies who were conceived after people got the shot coming out with birth defects. And then they're going to go, oh, gee, how could this be happening? And they're going to give some, there won't be any research relating this to the COVID shots, statistical or otherwise. And it'll be simply denial. Pfizer and Moderna have gone to the governments of Brazil and Argentina and other governments around the world, telling them hard, basically giving them the old arm wrestling that these governments are going to have to take the lawsuits and the payoffs that the governments are going to have to pay out to these everybody that's going to sue the pharmaceutical companies that provided the vaccine. And these governments are going, wait a minute, you didn't tell us that. That's after the fact. And the pharmaceutical companies are saying, no, your government has got to do this. And even in Brazil and Argentina, they're telling these countries that they have to put up for hack their military facilities to pay, because they're expecting it. It's going to come, boys and girls. The lawsuits are going to come, and they're already starting right now in The Hague. Remember the Nuremberg trials of World War II, post-World War II? They determined that the Germans had done all kinds of human experimentation on people without their consent, and so there was a very specific law passed worldwide that covers, in Israel, by the way, adopted this into their own laws, that you cannot have human experimentation. And of all countries on the planet, the ones that claim the Holocaust, etc., is where the most COVID, highest percentage of population receiving COVID vaccination at the heavy-handed administration of the government. It happened in Israel. The people that claim that the Holocaust was all about them and they were the victims of Hitler's Secret Service performing experiments on them, and then they now are subjugated to their own government, which should be there to protect them, you would think, against being forced vaccinated with the COVID vaccine that is untested. And so anyway, there are lawsuits now against the Israeli government. If you can imagine that, the one that should be protecting the Israeli citizens, I'm not going to go into the politics of that even being an Israelite country. That's another side issue. But for what the claims are, like I say, the claim of the Holocaust and being victim of the Holocaust in artificial experimentation on this population, isn't it bizarre that they are the ones that are now suing their own government for pushing this COVID vaccine onto their people? And there's also an attorney that's bringing the case towards the German government. And this, you're going to start to see this. But as I said, I predict that within 9 months, it's going to start. You're going to start to see the birth defects. And then the people are going to realize that this is irreversible. They have genetic damage being done to their body. And I would not be surprised if they drag Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation into court for promoting this. He's all over the place saying that, oh, we got to vaccinate the entire world. There's a guy that's nuts. There's Bill Gates is clinically insane and just living in some kind of, a fantasy world. But I've always said I want to see that guy on the street with a cup in his hand begging for nickels. That's a guy that should be taken to the cleaners and not let out, and his wife. These people are sick, deranged people. Okay, so anyway, just a quick review of my products. The wing generators there's a lot of interest. Also have the multi-blade systems. That's right for people who have high wind and have a lower, it's more home equipment, home electronics. The wing generator is industrial grade. It's about twice the cost. And so it's all good equipment. But anyway, the multi-blade systems have their place in the market. That's why I introduced them. The wing generator, the people that have serious energy needs. Let me just give you some examples of people who are working with wing generators. Say a person building a big new house out in the country who has really high energy needs. And this is just a house. It's not a business or anything else. Putting in a 50-kilowatt wing generator. And here's it's in a very good wind area. So that means that typically that system can produce around on average 50% of the energy from the wind or its nameplate value. If you look at the commercial models of the GE or Vesta, they're typically around 20% or less of their nameplate value. The wing generator is going to be 2.5 times that in a typical configuration. That's a lot of energy. 25 kilowatts of energy would be like a 25-kilowatt generator running 24/7. But, of course, there'll be times when the wind doesn't blow and the batteries are depleted, completely off-grid system, where there will be a backup generator. And so, anyway, these are hefty systems. Other people are looking at 25 kilowatts. Other people are looking at 2 kilowatts because they're just looking for a little backup system in case the power goes off. One person is in the medical profession and wants a small system so that basically can keep the lights on and keep things running for office appointments. And so there, in that case, a 2-kilowatt system was sufficient. So it's all over the board. So at any rate, I'm just about out of time here. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filters, all of this stuff is still on sale. In fact, you'll still see Christmas sales because I have not had time to get there and update the web pages. And so you still find the books, the education package on sale, other things on sale there. And so a good time to buy and, take advantage of those sales before I have time to get there. The webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.